The Guardian.
Maeve Kennedy, and I'm here to penetrate a space that I have yearned to get into since it first appeared on the London skyline, the extraordinary boat that became beached by some act of magic on top of the roof of the Queen Elizabeth Hall, teetering very unnervingly on the edge as if it wants to regain the river. I'm here to meet the award-winning American historian, professor of history at Harvard University, Maya Jazanov, who has been living in this extraordinary space for the last 4 days and is just about to be evicted. The boat is charmingly somewhere between Heart of Darkness and English suburbia. There's a welcome doormat, literally a welcome doormat, and Maya has just opened the door to me. Maya, in the time you've been here, you have seen Californian blue skies turn to much more typical London summer. Great banks of cloud and maybe a bit of a torrential downpour threatening. How's your time here been?
It's been really fantastic. You know, I've been to London many times before. I've done even some writing residencies before, but I've never had this kind of experience of being in a place where I'm meant to be thinking and writing, and I am thinking and writing about the place that I'm in. And I've also never had this kind of sustained look at London. And it's a very particular part of London. It's a part that extends from St. Paul's to Westminster. It's the church and it's the state. It's a part that sees throngs of office workers, tourists, everything seems to sort of come and go beneath the deck here. So it's just been a terrific perch.
When your book, Liberty's Exiles, came out, I felt acutely embarrassed because you had written about something that I had never spotted before, the lives of these people who remained loyalists and either stayed in America that had become unimaginably strange to them or left and drifted around the world, very much like Conrad's people, I think. Some of them must have washed up more or less exactly where you are now, in the centre of London. Did that strike you, the resonance between these lives you'd been writing about and the space you are now inhabiting?
Yeah, I think that I've always been interested as a historian and a writer in people who are washed up and circling around. And this is the link between the loyalist exiles I wrote about in the 18th century and Conrad's characters, as you suggest. And it's also, I think, given me a particular view of London as a place that involves an endless cycle of coming in and going out. And I think a lot of people associate, for example, the multi-ethnic, multicultural presence in London that so much characterizes London today, I think they associate it with the 20th century and the post-colonial period. But of course, it's actually very much also a phenomenon evident in the colonial period, the imperial period. It was empire that brought all of these things in and that sent all of these people out. And so the loyalists are just one of many, many populations that are coming in and washing up and moving around in London.
It's history of London that's flowing past your windows here.
It certainly is. One of the things that I was very struck by, though, is the difference between the riverscape now and how the riverscape would have looked in the past. You know, for the Jubilee flotilla, there will be 1,000 boats. And there's been much talk of how it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience to see 1,000 boats on the Thames. But of course, a couple hundred years ago, you could look out at the Thames on just this stretch in London at any time, and you would see more than 1,000 boats. It was a hub for maritime trade, and this meant that there was a constant traffic up and down the river. But in fact, there are 4,000 aircraft coming and going every day over London, and this seems to me the more marvelous thing that we now rather take for granted.
Have you been happy here? Have you been lonely here? Has it felt very peculiar?
It's actually felt incredibly populous and rich. And part of that, of course, is because there's so much going on around me. The days I've been here have had, by and large, magnificent weather. And so I've been sitting out on the deck and seeing people coming and going and seeing people sunning themselves and hearing buskers and, of course, listening to this constant traffic of trains and buses on Waterloo Bridge, Hungerford Bridge. So it's been very busy around me, but it's also been very busy, I think, in my mind. And that's what's been so extraordinary about being here, writing about this place, being inspired by this place. It suddenly brought me back, for example, in my mind to the first river, which I knew well, which was the East River in New York. It's not really a river, it's actually a strait. And so I felt as if my mind immediately had also become populated with memories of all kinds. So it's been a very, very stimulating spot to watch the world from.
So, as an American temporarily marooned in the center of London, which is about to explode in perhaps at least partly synthetic monarchist fervor, I wondered how you feel in the 21st century about the monarchy.
I sometimes think Americans are more obsessed with the British monarchy than the British themselves are. Monarchy gives us a wonderful fit of schadenfreude, on the one hand, to sort of see their travails through the years. But there's also something that we envy about it, and that's what I'm trying to work out for myself. I wonder if what we envy is a sense of stability, a sense of continuity, a sense that the monarchy in Britain today certainly tries to cultivate of itself as a protector of minority interests. So I think that we are wrong simply to dismiss it as a whole lot of bunting and frippery. And it's worth thinking about why there is this enduring obsession. But of course, at the same time, I can't help but feel that it's completely ludicrous to imagine these thousand boats and the barge Gloriana and the spirit of Charwell and all of that going down the Thames in honor of these people who just happened to be born in a particular place and a particular time.
I hope you find a good vantage point to admire it from now that you've been evicted from this wonderful space. And let's hear your exit essay.
River passage. From my bed ringed by 10 windows, I scarcely see the Thames, but the city unfolds from St. Paul's to Westminster, the river held in the arms of church and state. Most anywhere else, a box of windows on a roof would be a watchtower, and this could be a voyeur's paradise. It comes equipped with two sets of binoculars. The weather has been glorious, and in just 3 days of looking at the people flowing below, I've seen a summer's worth of joints and bellies bared to the sun. But sitting on deck, the London eye circling deliberately above me, I'm the most exposed, the odd woman out, on a ledge. I've discovered that nowhere from my aerie can I frame a photograph of the river naked, with no human trace. The nearest I get is a band of water with the pompon tops of two trees bobbing into the shot. It's mud brown, the kind of brown that can't be redeemed by warmer words like nutmeg or terracotta that summon the baked or the spiced. It winks at the sun as if it were an old roué who's gotten a rare chance to flirt. The Thames in London is less a river of nature than of nurture, bent and banked to the needs of a commercial city. It's been a hard-working river, backed by huge networks of 19th-century docks, built to hold the wealth of nations. It's witnessed devastation, as during the Great Fire, when thousands of Londoners hurled themselves into the Thames for safety, or the Blitz, when the docks became honey to the bombers. And it's been a jolly river, too, of pubs, pleasure gardens, and people messing about in boats, a river of spectacles and pageants. 2 days from now, 1,000 boats will fill this stretch of water to celebrate Queen Elizabeth II's Diamond Jubilee. I've seen it coming. Barricades clanged into place along Waterloo Bridge, pennants strung over Charing Cross Station, patrol boats slicing under Hungerford Bridge. Think Gloriana, the flotilla insists, for this, too, is an Elizabethan age. But in the 16th century, any day you looked, there were 2,000 boats on London's river. And by Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, there were 5,000 sailboats and 6,000 steamers registered on the river, together with oil tanks to fuel them, vast basins to hold them, warehouses to store their goods, and tens of thousands of laborers to service them. Ordinary Londoners chatted in terms owned by experts now. They recognized hoys, shallops, lighters, cutters, colliers, clinkers, ferries, and wherries, as clearly as you distinguish Ryanair from BA. Now, 1,000 boats have become a marvel, while London Terminal Control manages more than 4,000 flights per day. The first self-described river I knew was also an urban river, the East River in New York, which sadly isn't even a river but a strait dividing Manhattan from Long Island. My grandparents lived in a high-rise apartment complex called Waterside Plaza, which was as close to the river as it sounds. You could take an elevator to the bottom level of their building and step straight out onto a riverbank boardwalk, which my grandfather methodically paced for exercise. I'd trot ahead, past Miami Vice-style yachts, and up to the 34th Street heliport, where I'd stand against the chain-link fence with fingers in my ears, hair flying, to watch the helicopters lift and drop. In a fit of casual extravagance, my aunt once took me and my brother up for a heart-swelling swirl over Manhattan that still counts, adjusting for age, as one of the most exhilarating things I've ever done. Under the cracks in the boardwalk and around the slime-coated wooden posts lapped the river, with latherings of foam, clots of detritus, objects lost and tossed, clumps of feathers connoting avian tragedy. For a long time, I thought this was how real water, wild water, was meant to smell, briny and fishy, with a metallic finish that clapped your nose, a smell that grew richer and creamier the hotter it got. One day, on his walk by the East River, my grandfather had a stroke and dropped dead. He had been born in probably the most river-laced land in the world, what's now Bangladesh. So there was justice in dying next to a river, too, even if it's really a strait. In a later season, our family went to an uptown stretch of the East River, by Gracie Mansion, and leaned over a railing to let his ashes out of the bag, over the water, the way Hindus traditionally do. It was the right end in the wrong river. Thinking of the sacred rivers of India, T.S. Eliot wrote, "I do not know much about gods, but I think that the river is a strong brown god, sullen, untamed, intractable." What power do rivers wield? Rivers thread, line, cut, or snake and lattice through landscapes. They run, they rush, they fall, they rise, flood, and course. Rivers can be bridged, forded, dammed, covered over, and tunneled beneath. Rivers have beginnings and ends, sources and mouths. They have currents, direction, and by implication, purpose. The metaphors they invite concern time, volume, and trajectories. Rivers of life and death. Rivers of blood, gold, tears and sorrows, rivers of dreams, history, and faith. When you travel by river, you are either going up or coming down. It's quite different when you journey by sea. Seas stretch and spread beyond visible bounds. They have shores, not banks. They're wide, not long. The river is within us. The sea is around us, says Eliot. Seas have waves, swells, and tides. They're moody and consuming. They buffet, heave, toss, and swallow. While river time is linear, spanning the past and the future, time at sea is circular, orbital, defined by the moon and stars. While on rivers you travel with or against the current, at sea you are, well, at sea. You can think you're heading for China and find yourself in Cuba. You can set course for Virginia and wash up in Massachusetts. Seas speak of freedom, rife with dangers, rich with possibilities. stories about rivers and stories about seas, or at least the European and American ones that I know best, each have certain distinctive features. Stories about rivers often involve passages from an exterior to an interior, and a search for something hidden, something rumored, concealed treasure, secret passages, disguised points of origin or egress. Some of the best-known river stories happen to be true, and histories, like that of Walter Raleigh questing for El Dorado on the Orinoco, or René Caillé struggling up the Niger to Timbuktu, or Livingston, Burton, and the rest looking for the source of the Nile. You can follow a river into something, but you always put out to sea. Sea stories dramatize a tension between the contained and the infinite, the enclosed shipmates afloat in an ocean, the castaway on an island, the one true star that guides away. A ship in a sea is a ship in a bottle. In sea stories, things aren't so much hidden as they are simply unknown and open-ended. Where will we land? What shall we find? At sea, you're much more likely than on a river to run into creatures with three heads or six arms or one eye. It's by sea that you'll find Scylla and Charybdis, the Winims, and the great white whale. The sea invites fantasy, marvel, and the unexpected, which may be why the best-known sea stories are fiction. When Joseph Conrad joined the British Merchant Marine in the 1870s, Europeans had charted the coastlines that had eluded them just a century or two before. Nobody any longer rendered California as an island or left off the western half of Australia. Indeed, seacoasts were more prosperous and populous than ever. Before 1800, the great world capitals, Rome, Cairo, Beijing, Mexico City, lay inland, safe from marauders, fed by hinterlands. Many of today's megacities, by contrast, Rio, Lagos, Calcutta, Hong Kong, sit on coasts where Europeans decided to put them. By Conrad's time, imperialism and industrialization had tamed seas into highways, while the great mysteries lay inland. Conrad spent 20 years as a merchant sailor, almost entirely on British ocean-going ships. He made numerous passages to Singapore and Australia, and spent more than 2 years at a stretch cruising around Siam and the Dutch East Indies, particularly Borneo. Conrad's last command, though he didn't plan it that way, in 1890, was a 6-week stint on the Roi des Belges, a steamer plying the Congo River in the vast swathe of Central Africa that was run as a personal colonial fiefdom by King Leopold II of Belgium. Set against the rest of his maritime career, Conrad's Congo journey was brief, anomalous, and unforgettable. He saw firsthand some of the outrages that made Leopold's Congo Free State into a synonym for slaughter and abuse. It was, in every way, a very bad trip. When Conrad began writing fiction, at about the time he traveled to Congo, he worked with what he knew best. He wrote of the sea, of Borneo, and, in his words, human outcasts such as one finds in the lost corners of the world. But he loathed being classified as a writer of sea stories. 12 years after publishing his first novel, he at last wrote a book without boats. "I have just finished a novel with not a drop of water in it, except the rain, which is quite natural since everything takes place in London," he announced. It was called The Secret Agent, and would, he hoped, shatter preconceived notions of Conrad as sea writer. I wonder what Conrad would have made of the fact that, a century later, he's remembered less for any of this than for just one early work, Heart of Darkness. Like the Congo journey that inspired it, the novella is brief, anomalous, and unforgettable. Brief enough to be written in 6 weeks over a Christmas holiday and serialized in 3 parts. Anomalous because Conrad's imagination, otherwise, was deep in Borneo, where he set the books he was writing before and after Heart of Darkness, and where Marlowe made his next appearance, in Lord Jim. And unforgettable because the power of Heart of Darkness resides in its breaking and blending of conventions. For Conrad's great achievement in Heart of Darkness is to write the quintessential river story by making it also, in some sense, a story of the sea. The beginning unfolds in an estuary where river and sea meet. It's told on the deck of a sailing yacht by a mariner who still followed the sea. Its language mixes oceanic metaphors of mystery and the infinite with a riverine awareness of lineages and secrets. It turns a classic river passage from an exterior to an interior into the seaman's nightmare of drifting in a limitless expanse of horror. What starts as a search for sources becomes a search for monsters. That's why, in Conrad's vision, all rivers begin to flow into one another, just as the seas do. The rivers of Borneo, which Conrad knew best, run in his imagination into the Congo. The Congo runs into the Thames. In other hands, the Congo will run into the Mekong and the Amazon. After Conrad, any river can come to a bad end. On my last day aboard this version of the Roi des Belges, a boat run aground on a roof, how's that for an unforgettable anomaly? Clouds blinded the sun, rain flicked the windows. The outlook for the Reine de la Grande-Bretagne's pageant wasn't too bright. But enough with the outlook, I thought. I had to get out and about. I walked to Greenwich, past signs of prosperity blighted and renewed, survivals and excavations. And at Rotherhithe, passing one of the riverside stairs, a London cot, a sound stopped me short. It slurped and chuckled. It was the tide of the river licking the muddy bank. It was, unmistakably, the sound of the sea.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.